This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10104. Lecture 26, delivered on the 25th of November of 2008. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, Review for Exam 2. I will not directly ask anything from Exam 1, except with the exception of one question. But there will obviously be Exam 1 material in Exam 2 simply because of the cumulative nature of the course and some of the concepts of supply and demand dynamics and all of that. Aside from that one question, I will be focusing on the material that we have covered since Exam 1. And I will be going through this review in no particular order here. There will be some themes that I'll explore here. But as far as something that I would ask directly from Exam 1 is one of the most important concepts in microeconomics. What is the profit-maximizing condition? And I've asked you this before. As a matter of fact, I've encouraged you to get this tattooed on your ass. And I will expect that. That would be worth many extra bonus points. Don't do it. I don't want to see it. But you need to know what the profit maximizing condition of the firm is. You need to know that. Okay, now let's get away from that here. As I closed off the material of Exam 1, I had given you the spectrum of industry concentration types as a taxonomy, going from perfect competition through monopolistic competition and on to oligopolies, cartels, and monopolies. So there is a transitional boundary there where I will be exploring the details of the types of industries. I will ask you questions about what constitutes the assumptions of perfect competition. I will ask you about what the consequences of that are. The price-taking, perfectly competitive firm faces a perfectly elastic demand curve, so the marginal revenue curve is right on the demand curve, and all that kind of stuff. I will certainly expect you to know that. As far as monopolies go, I will get into the details. In your quizzes, you had a question where I showed you a graph of demand, marginal revenue, supply, marginal cost of a monopolist. And I asked you about where is the output level of the monopolist, what price will the monopolist charge. I will do that on this exam. Again, I will revisit that problem. I will also ask you something about what would be the output level and price in perfect competition, looking at this graph. Make sure you know how to read those graphs, because I will ask you that again. I will ask you about the assumptions behind monopolistic competition. Let me do this. With respect to you, looking at an industry, what would be, not necessarily the dead giveaway, but a really good indication that you were looking at a firm or firms in a monopolistically competitive environment? What would be the almost dead giveaway? What? No, I'm saying just as a regular consumer without doing any numbers. You would look. No, you're still thinking economist. You would, which is great. I'm glad to hear, but you'd see advertising. You'd see advertising. Why do monopolistic competitors advertise. What is the purpose of advertising?
So their product is its own thing.
What do we call that? What's the term we use for that? Product differentiation. Yes. Product differentiation. Yeah, you're right though. That's what it is, but we call it product differentiation. And what is the purpose in economics? Now getting into the economics and the graphing and all that. What is the purpose of advertising? What are they trying to do? Okay, now you're going the other way. No, they're trying to make their demand curve downward sloping. Because once the demand curve is downward sloping, the marginal revenue curve emerges underneath it, which means that the marginal cost intersects marginal revenue at a lower output level, which means they can charge a higher price. That's the purpose of the advertising, is to get them out of the perfect competition hell, where they are just price takers instead of price setters. Now, don't get me wrong, advertising, you can actually see advertising in oligopolies and monopoly, oligopolistic and monopolistic industries as well. It's to an entirely different purpose there. Oftentimes in those kinds of industries, you'll see advertising to make consumers feel good about their loving monopolist. This is oftentimes done for political reasons. Around the turn of the century, Microsoft was pumping out these real feel-good ads with the colorful butterfly that Microsoft used for kind of a logo for a while, and just real gooey kinds of ads. The reason was because that they were in the final stages of a legal battle from hell with the United States government over their antitrust practices from the 1990s. So Microsoft wanted everyone to feel good about their product. As a matter of fact, companies like that, and I'm not saying Microsoft would do it, certainly not. You know, Bill Gates does nothing wrong. But they will actually even pay people to go on the internet, on message boards, and to defend them and to promote them. And how do I know that? Because I was paid to do that myself for some companies, to defend their reputations from critics. In the 1970s, interestingly enough, during the OPEC oil embargo and the time after that, when people were really pissed off at the oil companies, you started seeing ads by the oil companies. They were not doing those ads for a competitive reason. They were just simply trying to get people to feel good about them again so that there would not be a crackdown by Congress on their practices. It was quite dramatic. Exxon, I remember to this day, just an amazingly uplifting, upbeat commercial showing all the things that Exxon was going to be doing. It was telling, I wish I could, I was looking on YouTube because I wanted you to see. Exxon was trying to get everyone to know that they were really working for us. It was energy for a strong America. And they had these incredible scenes of giant windmills spinning like this. And they had solar power arrays. And then they showed this amazing picture of this high-powered laser firing into a deuterium pellet for the fusion reactions. All of that stuff back in the 1970s. We're working for you. We're going to get through this energy crisis, by God. Energy for a strong America. Well, here we are today, and we're still where we were then. But Exxon did this just not to get you to buy their gasoline so much as to just get people so that they didn't get so pissed that they would make their congressmen pass draconian laws cracking down on the oil industry. Microsoft, same deal. But anyway. And to a certain extent, the telecoms have done this too. They are certainly not oligopoly. No doubt they're not oligopoly. But they certainly want to have you have feel good ads about them. That's the whole point, is for you to love them. Like, you know, that guy for Verizon. Can you hear me now? Good. No one wants to hurt this guy. This guy's okay. You know, he's just doing his job. So they're trying to make you feel good about the fact that they are providing you with service. Never mind the fact that they engaged in an illegal massive spying operation at the behest of the government. Never mind the fact that they are essentially consolidating control of the telecommunications world. The same is true for Google. Google wants everything to you to feel good about everything they do. Google is even running a global philanthropy group, google.org. Oh, they got to make you feel good, even though they are actually turning into a monopoly of far greater power and menacing threat than Microsoft. But that's neither here nor there. I will have you calculate Hirschman-Herfindahl Index. HHI Index. I always call it the HERF. I will also, with regard to the HERF, ask you something about the polls. What's the lowest and the highest? What do these mean? If I told you that a HERF was 10,000, what would that mean? If I told you that a HERF was 0, what would that mean? If I told you that a HERF was 8,000, what would that mean? If I told you that a HERF was 1,000, what would that mean? Okay? Now, there are obviously fuzzy areas in there, and I'm not going to push you, but you should know about, for example, with market share, where the triggers are, at least with respect to serious market concentration. Okay? Also, with respect to oligopolies, what's the characteristic? Well, oligopolies. You see, you could have an oligopoly and an industry in perfect competition. And despite what the book says that in monopolistic competition. Despite what the book says that monopolistic competition always has many, many firms. Not necessarily. Monopolistic competition can exist, and there don't have to be that many firms. You could have an oligopoly and a monopolistically competitive industry in which there was not that much difference in the number of firms, but there was a difference, not visible to the outsider so much, perhaps, but internally, in terms of decision making. What is it about oligopolies that's so different in terms of internal decision making? You know? They're strategic pricers. Remember how I told you that oligopolies are not like normal companies? Oligopolies look out at the field in front of them as a multidimensional field of their fellow companies in the industry and time. They don't price for today. They don't compete for today. They are going to live forever. And they are going to look at the world out there in terms of time and position as a chessboard with their fellow players in the industry off in distant parts, and each one moves marginally over time, and all of them price strategically. Now, that doesn't mean that their prices don't move rapidly. Certainly in the oil industry, you see the prices going up and down. But underneath it, they are not pissing themselves about prices going up and down. They know that they are going to be there tomorrow and the next day and in the decades to come. They have to be concerned about those long runs far more than the short run, because they are so capital heavy, so big, they are not going to fall. They're just going to keep going. Okay, that's enough. Make sure that you know about details of the different kinds of industries, the market concentrations, the characteristics of each. Make sure you know about perfect competition, the perfectly elastic demand curve, and intersecting the marginal cost curve, and all of that kind of stuff. Let me run here to recent material. Make sure that you know about auctions, different kinds. if I describe an auction to you, I would expect you to be able to tell me what kind it is. If I ask you for an example of a type of auction, I would certainly expect you to be able to indicate what's what. So, for example, what would be an example? Oh, okay, let me do this. Let me do it this way. I am opening bids for the services of this young man, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, at $5. Do I hear 10? English. I noticed no one did 10, for God's sake. What the hell? You know, that tells you. Oh, sorry. Okay. That's in English because I'm working my way up. What would be an example of a Dutch auction? Say that. The house, yes. Yeah, yeah, and an example of that would be a housing market. Yes, as a matter of fact. Now, let me do this one, and you tell me which one it is. Union labor management negotiations. Dutch. Because you go into the negotiations at high, and then, you know, we want 12% raise, you know, we want big benefits, you know, control of the universe, and then you work your way down. By the time you come out of there, well, we got our asses kicked, we got 2%. But that's a Dutch auction. Very good. That's Dutch. Now, as far as, other matters in risk, I want you to know what winner's curse is. I have been seeing winner's curse. Even last night, I saw winner's curse. eBay seems to be overrun with winner's curse. To give you a great example, last night on eBay, I've been trying to bid on a high-end, high-definition, semi-professional video camera so that I can do the video lectures more professionally. And the auction started at a very low price. By the end, in the last 10 minutes, the price of this video camera had gone to well over $600. You can buy the camera new for $400. But, they just kept bidding the damn thing up. By the end, I think it finished, it was like $679. And sanity check, I kept going over to the website where this one company was, one brand new, same thing, everything the same, and it wasn't used, and it was hugely less. So that's winner's curse, and it's real. It is very real. Say that again.
So that's not a curse, that's stupid.
Well, you think to yourself, these people are nuts. This has got to be temporary. But I've seen it over and over again, especially in the electronics markets. The auctions are finishing stupid high. Almost every time, the auctions are finishing well above what you could buy new for the same product. And it didn't used to be that way. When I first was on eBay, you didn't see winner's curse. But now, it's like, in economics terms, you would almost want to say this is irrational. But as I explained to you, apparently there is huge benefit in just winning these auctions. And so you're paying the enormous premiums just to say you won. But anyway, make sure you know about moral hazard, too. Well, moral, I will push it, the difference. But moral hazard, it's a good question that you asked there. Also, adverse selection, what that's all about. Say that again. Adverse selection. People who would tend to have a greater need for indemnification will be more likely to seek the indemnification. And therefore, as a result of that, people who participate in those risk pools, like insurance, who don't need indemnification will end up subsidizing everyone else. Like you. Well, you might want health insurance. That would be great. But you're not going to be the one who beats up that. The people who are screaming for national health insurance, just bawling for it, are the people who are going to beat the hell out of the medical system. They're going to bring their kids in. They're going to bring their own crippled bodies in. They're going to be the ones who have abused their bodies their whole lives. They're going to be the ones who want this the most. And then they are going to expect that everyone will be forced to participate in the system, which is the ugly dark side of socialism, is that the weak are not given the proper incentives to get strong. Now, in a civil society, we do have to protect the weak. But the question is, to what extent do we, when are we doing that so much that we are encouraging weakness? It would be, for example, you would see in my political writings, I would condemn national health insurance, but I would certainly support a national health care plan for children. They can't, they don't deserve the shit that's put on them as far as their sicknesses go. But that's the point of adverse selection, is that it tends to, and it tends to bring in everyone who really wants it, and then those who are going to beat up the system use the system, get the indemnification, and then take advantage of it. And that's why it gets difficult when you get into a workplace. Young singles tend to be pretty darned healthy, but in a workforce that is aging, you're going to be paying insurance premiums through the employer, and the employer will too. That will include a lot of people who have kids, a lot of people who are getting into the age when they have medical problems, many of them of their own creation, just like me. And that's going to create problems because, you know, sooner or later, the young people are going to say, FTS, this is ridiculous. Why am I paying for what I am not doing? And so the liberal trend that we seem to be having a little bit of now will find its way back around eventually, which is unfortunate in some ways. Okay, now, I had you read an article called Pumpkins and Futures. Let me ask you this. And don't spare my feelings, okay? When I write these articles, I'm writing them for a popular audience, not dumb people. You know, you don't have knuckle draggers. Well, I do have knuckle draggers come to my site. They come there, just look at this stuff, him bad, him not my friend. And then they send me death threats. But the readers of my sites are a more intelligent audience. And although certainly a lot of them would not have your level of active training going on and education going on. They might have gone to college, but they long ago forgotten whatever it was they learned in college. So I have to write these articles on, even when I'm getting technical, I have to get very, try to make it bite size. Did you understand how futures work from what I did, from what I wrote in that article? Did it make sense to you how I described it? Go ahead.
The one thing I understand is when the futures contract went up,
yes,
or when it went down, he had to end up paying more for it.
Well, yeah, because essentially when it went down, he had to settle the account because it wasn't worth as much as he had entered it for. So he had bought a contract willing to accept delivery at some certain price. So when the contract went down in price, that means that he was going to have to accept delivery at a lower price. So he had to make good on the price difference between what he had originally agreed to deliver at and what he was then going to have to. So the people who had paid him previously had agreed to pay a price. Well, when the price of the contract goes down, in order for that contract to be fulfilled, he'll have to offer them the lower price. But they bought, understanding that they'd pay a higher price. So he has to settle on that before the contract can reform again. Essentially, every day, there's a settlement that happens. Did any of you see, I know it's been a few years since you're before your time, the Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd movie, Trading Places.
Yes.
Did Did any of you see that? I loved the movie. It was so totally over the top. But it actually was exactly how futures markets work. That last scene where they were in that, at the end of the movie, those two bad guys had done all these contracts assuming that orange juice was going to be at an extremely high price when oranges were delivered. But when it turned out that there wasn't going to be any freeze out down in the south, the price of oranges fell, and the spot price collapsed, and the futures price collapsed. So what essentially happened when that guy walked up from the exchange and said, margin call, he was saying, now you have to make good on the difference between what you were going to deliver at a high price and what now people can get at a lower price. Because essentially, those people who had bought at the high price, they'll just go in and buy contracts at the lower price, and then they will force sale of the higher price contracts. And it's horrible. I mean, that's where you can get really caught with your pants down, and that's why futures markets are dangerous for small-time participants. Because essentially every day, you've got a margin call. You're either up or you've got to pay off the difference. What's bad about this too, and there's a little side story. At the end of every day, there's a settlement. You either get money if the contract went up, or you pay money if the contract went down. Every day that happens. One of the worst things that happened was this whole mania, hysteria, with the terrorism and all that. There was a provision put in the Patriot Act that accounts, payments between banks of over a certain amount of money could not happen in the normal way. There would have to be paperwork filled out for any payment over movement of money over $10,000 between banks. And also there would be delays on any money that was paid over a certain amount. Freeze on any transfers of funds. You have had over the past, since the Patriot Act was passed, millions of small-time investors playing futures markets who had margin calls above $10,000, and they couldn't meet the margin call. They had the money to pay, but they couldn't transfer the money to pay the exchange the amount of the margin call. The bank could not do it. It was frozen by the Patriot Act. These people got in worlds of trouble legally because they were not fulfilling their margin calls because they couldn't transfer the funds because of the Patriot Act's provisions against transfers of over a certain amount of money. Let that be a lesson to you. Talk about the law of unintended consequences. Now, as far as what I would ask on an exam goes about futures contracts, I'm certainly not going to ask you to do a numerical example, deal with a numerical example. But I would ask you certain provisions. What do I mean by margin call? Or would you face a margin call if the price was that when you bought and the price at the end of the day was something else? Would you face a margin call? What do I mean by the spot and forward? If I say spot, does that mean I'm calling for my dog? No. A spot is the prevailing price as opposed to a forward price. What is characteristic of futures contracts versus forward contracts in general? Futures contracts are a subset of forward contracts. What's the thing about futures contracts that makes them different from other kinds of forward contracts? Can you put it in one word? Would anyone want to try? I think I mentioned it. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do mention it in the article. It's standardization. Futures contracts all have the same provisions. So when you buy a futures contract, it's not a freewheeling kind of contract. They all have specific dates when they expire. They all have specific amounts. If you buy a pork belly, a futures contract on pork bellies, there are a specific number of pork bellies involved in that. There's a specific expiration date when the bellies would be delivered. Now, if you ride a futures contract out to the end, let's say on pork bellies, does that mean that you bought one contract on pork bellies. Does that mean that you will have, if you ride the contract out to the end, you will have 100,000 pork bellies delivered to your door? No. No, that's not how futures contracts work. Okay? Also, in order to close your position in a futures contract, how is that done? If you're in a futures contract, let's say you have bought a futures contract. How do you close that position?
I don't remember what it's called. You're going
to
sell.
That's right. You have to write the, you have to take the opposite position. And the two cancel each other out. That's how you close. See, when you buy stock, when you're done, you just sell it. That's not how futures contracts work. If I was a buyer of one contract on pork bellies, in order to get out of that contract, I have to write a contract on pork bellies. In other words, sell a contract on pork bellies. It's not your contract that you're selling. You are actually selling a new contract which has the same provisions as the contract. It would be the same expiration date and everything. And so those two meet each other and essentially cancel each other out. That's what's weird about futures contracts. They're not like normal buying and selling at all. And if you have the time, as I've said with a lot of my articles, and you'll hear this next semester if you take me for macro, read my articles twice. It is amazing how much more. And don't read them right one time, then right away again. Give it a few days, then read it again. You will be amazed at how much clearer things are on the second reading. Again, this will be very especially true next semester when, if you're in my class, you will be reading a whole series of articles that I have published on the economy. At first, they are just as opaque as hell. But then if you read them again, then it makes a lot more sense. And I've had many people affirm this. Yes, when I read it the second time, it made sense to me. It's almost that whole idea. Have you ever been reading a book and then suddenly you ask yourself, what the hell did I just read for the last 12 pages? You know, it becomes clear the second time you read it. Okay, now let me go on. This is obviously not exhaustive, what I'm doing here. But I do want to emphasize that I'll ask you these specifics about forward contracts and risk in general. I want you to know the difference. First of all, what is the fundamental first axiom of finance? The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. If you want more, you have to take more risk. You, woman, could spend your life down in your basement eating Cheetos and playing World of Warcraft. But you're not going to make a whole lot of money. No one's going to reward you for that. Okay? Although there are these people selling their characters, their accounts at huge prices for World of Warcraft. I mean, it's stupid. I mean, there's this... Very high guild members can sell at 50 grand or things like that. I mean, just unbelievable.
I've never heard of 50 grand.
I have.
Really?
Heavy duty. And you know, people put their whole lives into this stupid stuff. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Did you see that article of last week, the woman's divorcing her husband because
he cheated on her in second wife?
Yes.
It was great.
Yes. She said she got so sick of going and seeing him having, you know, the thing with his, with the Second Life animated character. You know, that's just, you know, man, dude, I don't care if you do have a powerful computer. Quit it. That's not right. But you will get a higher expected return for bearing greater risk. However, you are not given an expected you should not expect a greater return if the risk you are bearing is stupid risk. If you can diversify away that risk, then there is certainly no reason to reward you for that risk. A NASCAR driver who wins the race wearing no safety protective equipment at all gets no more than the driver who wore the helmet and had all the straps and all that kind of stuff. You're not rewarded for dumb risk. Unless the dumb risk was actually the point, as for example in something like the movie Jackasses. Well, it was Dumbasses too, but Jackasses. Have you ever seen Jackasses? Okay, those guys don't deserve to live. But they were rewarded because they were stupid. I mean, sometimes you'll pay people to be stupid. But that aside, you will certainly, if it is a risk that can be diversified away, you should not be rewarded for bearing that risk. There's no way. In terms of risk, so there is the diversifiable versus the non-diversifiable. If you can diversify away the risk, you should not expect any extra return for having borne that risk. So make sure you understand the first principle of finance. Now, with respect to risk and all of that, oh, that reminds me, I will ask you to calculate yield, treasury bill yield, just like I did on the quiz. Same thing. Not the same exact numbers. I'm not that stupid. But same exact question in terms of here's the price of the instrument. What's the yield? Now, also, I'll ask you something, a present value type of question, or a future value. I'll probably ask you both a present value and a future value question. And what I'll do there is the present value question might be one like that one on the quiz. You've paid $800 now. One thing I want to comment on the quiz, most of you got it just fine. But a couple of cautions to you. I noticed that in question 3, I told you, well, if you invest $800 now, you'll get such and such money 1 year from now, some more money 2 years from now, some more money 3 years from now. Okay, two things. I noticed that a number of you got the present value of the future cash flows wrong by about $10. You got $1,007 instead of $1,017. Watch it with rounding. Watch it, for God's sake. In intermediate steps in finance, rounding can turn into a disaster because values magnify through time. And if you start making mistakes in the first 3 years of a cash flow analysis, those can explode as time goes on if there are more years and you are reinvesting and things like that. So be careful. Also,
did you say the correct was 1017?
Yes, 1017. Now let me bring something else up here. Yeah, some of you actually gave me an answer. You said, yes, because you will earn $217. Don't do that. That's not exactly right. Yeah, you're investing $800. The present value of your expected future cash flows, your future expected cash flows, is $1,017. But that does not mean that you're earning $217. The term that we use in financial economics, finance and financial analysis, the difference between what you invest and what you get, what the present value is, we call that the net present value, NPV. Now, in decision making, in budgeting, decision making, whenever the NPV is positive, you should accept the project. Whenever it's negative, you should reject the project. So it doesn't matter whether it's a dollar or $217 or $5,000. If it's a positive, it is a go, always. The net present value is actually just a simple up or down. Positive, yes. Negative, no. So with respect to this investment, the NPV was $217. You accept this investment not because it was $217, but because it was a positive number. Period. Really. So it boils down to a simple up or down. If 800 minus the present value of the future cash flow, expected cash flows, was positive, yes. If it was negative, no. But that's a trivial point. And I'm sure if you run into me on a finance course, you'll hear me bitch about that to no end. Yeah, I'll ask you, Bond. I also might ask you a more general question about the difference between bills, notes, and bonds. I brought that up. Remember that, what's the difference between a bill, just generically, what's the difference between a bill and a bond?
Time,
yeah. Bills are very short-term, bonds are very long-term. The intermediates are the notes. I'll show you something interesting here. And you'll get this. Of course, all of you are signed up for my macro class next semester, right? You're like, I'm never going to come through near you again, teacher. Show you something here. It's kind of interesting. Ma'am, look at the top of that right there. What does that say right there at the top of this dollar bill?
Federal Reserve note.
Say that last word.
Note.
Note. See, this is actually a debt instrument. This is a evidence of an indebtedness of the Federal Reserve as the agent of the Treasury. This is actually a promissory note. And the fact that it says note is actually important here because this note will survive for about 5 years. They are saying literally on the front of this that this is a bill, that this is a kind of debt instrument issued by the United States government through its agency, the Federal Reserve, representing an obligation of the government to satisfy the value of this instrument. It's face value. And its face value there is one. See that face value? It's actually written on the promissory note, the intermediate term debt instrument of the United States government. But actually, if you look very carefully here, it does not say that it is backed by the full faith, backed by the United States government. The note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Oh, don't do that. It says in God we trust, but do you think God's going to pay this? What is the only evidence on this that the government has something to do with this instrument? No. I'll show you. Who are the signatories? Yeah, they are government officials. That's the only actual evidence on the note itself that this is actually a government-backed instrument, that the government is doing any kind of guarantee on it whatsoever. If you take a business law course from me, you'll learn something called the parole evidence rule, which is informally known as the Four Corners Doctrine. In a written contract, if it is not on if it is not written, it is not part of the contract, unless there is some traditional expectation that is normal to these. But otherwise, the parole evidence rule simply says that don't assume anything in a written contract that is not in the writing of the contract, language of the contract itself. In other words, Four Corners Doctrine. You have to look in the four corners. If it ain't in the four corners of that contract, it ain't part of the agreement. Think about that with those dollar bills. Might even scare you a little bit with respect to those. But anyway, that's all conspiracy theory anyway. There will be other things. Obviously, I've not been exhaustive here today. Do you have any questions about what's going to be on this exam? It's 50 questions, multiple guess, same format. You're allowed a 4x6 note card. Four inch by 6 inch, not 4 feet by 6 feet, for God's sake. 4 inch by 6 inch. No. Formula card, I should say. I will put formulas, as I did on the first exam. There will be formulas on a sheet at the end of the exam for this one. Say that again.
5x7 last time or not?
No. 5x7? Are you nuts, woman? No. That's like a portrait, No, not 5x7. Besides, do they even make 5x7 index cards? What are they? What kind of filing do you have to stop that? 4x6. It sounds to me like I'm in an English auction here. And I'm trying to hold this.
Nice try, though.
Yeah, nice try. I've never done a 4-5-7. I wouldn't do that. You know, people would be waffling their cards around. Okay, do you have any other questions for this? Oh, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.